You're listening to Bits of Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. This bonus episode features Ruth Brennan, whose period started to change when she was 36 years old. A few years later, she was diagnosed with POI, or premature ovarian insufficiency. Ruth shares her experience of setting out to get answers, entering menopause early, dealing with the reality that she was infertile, minding her bone health, and re-evaluating her identity as a woman in this world. So you were in your 30s when your period started to get irregular, and then when you were 38, you were diagnosed with POI, is that right?
Yeah, so I noticed my periods started to get irregular when I was 36. And I think I noticed because my periods were always like really, really regular. And I didn't really take much notice of it for the first couple of years because like stress can make you miss periods and things like that. Mm. And it was a really random reason that made me actually go get blood tests. I was having a massage one day, and I just happened to mention to the person giving me the massage that like my periods were a bit irregular, and I was like I didn't know whether I should be worried about them or not. And she just said, oh, why don't you just go and get some blood tests done, which I hadn't actually thought about. So when I got the blood tests done, the GP said to me, they're generally normal. There's nothing to worry about. The FSH, the follicle stimulating hormone, is a little bit high, but that's probably down to stress because she knew I was doing a PhD. Sure, come back to me in a few months when you're finished your PhD and we'll see. We'll do the test again, but there's nothing to worry about. But being a social scientist, I wanted to look at the results myself. So I said, can you send me a copy of the results? Which she did. So I started Googling, which is usually not a very good thing to do. And I was Googling my FSH results, and I kept coming up with pages that were talking about, at that time it was called premature ovarian failure.
Okay.
Which was really, really shocking to see. So I went back to her and I said, I don't know if something is wrong or if something has been missed, but this is what I'm getting when I'm Googling these results. And can you let me know what you think? And she came back and said, yes, there is a problem. I'm going to have to refer you to a specialist fertility clinic. She said something like, oh, the lab ranges were incorrect or something like that. But I'm not quite sure I ever got to the bottom of that, whether she actually misread the results, whether it was the fault of the lab. But if I hadn't actually asked her for the results and kind of done my own kind of research, I would have kind of gone merrily on my way thinking, okay, I'm just like seriously stressed during this PhD, and there's nothing else wrong with me.
And when she said that she was going to refer you to a fertility clinic, had you been talking about fertility or anything to do with like thinking about or wanting to have kids, or was that just because of the fact that this was impacting on your egg reserves?
It was just because it was impacting on my egg reserves, and I think she knew when the FSH levels were that high, that she could see that it was a perimenopausal or menopausal profile, even though she didn't say that to me at the time. So it wasn't because we had been discussing me wanting to have children or fertility or anything like that.
Mm. And I suppose being that age, being perimenopausal maybe wouldn't be massively shocking, but I would assume that the levels that you were seeing were suggesting that you were close to menopause at that point.
Absolutely. And even like perimenopausal wasn't even a term that was in my kind of lexicon at that stage. I had never heard of the term perimenopausal. I didn't know what it meant. She certainly didn't say perimenopausal to me at the time. And what I actually did then, because I had no trust in her after she had told me everything was okay and suddenly everything is really wrong.
Yeah.
So I actually went to again, it was a bit of a roundabout way. I ended up going to an acupuncturist who was recommended to me because she specialised in fertility. And she said to me, you need to go get your anti-Müllerian hormone tested, which again was a hormone that I had never heard of. And because usually the GP would have tested for luteinizing hormone, estradiol, from estrogen and follicle stimulating hormone. But anti-Müllerian hormone is used as an indicator of the amount of primordial follicles or eggs that you have actually left. So it's an indicator of what your egg reserve is.
Okay.
So I went to a private clinic to get that check done. And that was the first time I started to hear about, to hear the word perimenopausal and to realise that, that something was really wrong.
Mm. And at what point were you first, or when did you first hear about POI?
Well, I mean, my first encounter with POI, or premature ovarian failure, as it was called then, was like from my initial Google searches on the internet. And the next time I heard about it was when I was in a consultation in, with the consultant in the private clinic to discuss the results of my anti-Müllerian hormone test. And the results of that test was that my AMH levels were so low that they couldn't even be measured by the test. Okay. And when you get the results of the test, like, so they send them to you by email in a locked PDF. And when you get the results of the test, they have like these different ranges for normal AMH levels for different age ranges. And I could see that mine was like for women who were much, much older than me, mine was even below the level that would be normal for women who are much, much older than me.
Yeah.
And I just remember the word negligible that was everywhere on that piece of paper.
Yeah.
It was like it was really hard. It was like it said like a negligible response to fertility drugs expected. Ovarian follicle profile suggests a negligible ovarian reserve. A negligible egg yield, and then this is a menopause profile. So that was the first time I'd heard menopause was when I opened that PDF, which happened to be on a night bus in Mexico, which probably wasn't the best place to receive that news.
Yeah. How did you feel?
I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach, and that wasn't the first, I think the first time I felt that kind of punch to the stomach was when the GP called me to confirm, yes, there is something wrong. And then the next time was when I was having an ultrasound in that private clinic, and I was asking the nurse a lot of questions. And she eventually said, I think you need to prepare yourself for bad news. And then when I opened those results, it was, I just remember sitting on that bus and pulling kind of the hood, my hood over my head, and just crying silently for that journey. It was really surreal. It was like there was so much information to process. There were so many things I just hadn't even considered happening to me at that age. I mean, I was 38 at the time. I had always wanted to have children. I thought I would have children. I wasn't in a relationship at the time, so I hadn't started trying to have children. And all of a sudden, it was like this big thing that I thought was going to be part of my life going forward was taken away from me.
Hmm. So you got that. You were sent the results that you opened when you were in Mexico. And what happened next? Were you kind of put on a treatment path, or did you go to see anyone?
No, what happened next was that, so after you get the results, you can book, you were able to book with the consultant to discuss the results. So that didn't happen until a month later, because I was in Mexico, and that was, there was a bit of space between me and the diagnosis at that stage, because I was in somewhere that wasn't familiar. I was like on an expedition that was kind of requiring a lot of kind of physical and mental energy. So it really only hit me a month later when I came back. But no, I think what was really notable about that consultation was, well, by that, at that time I had learned that I needed to bring someone with me, because I hadn't when I had gone for the scan.
Yeah.
I was in a fertility clinic surrounded by couples, and I was sitting there on my own, and I received that news of you need to prepare yourself for bad news when I was on my own. And that was awful, really, really awful to receive that without anybody there kind of in the room or with me immediately afterwards to support me. I'd learned to bring a friend, and that was, I mean, it was a very thorough consultation. He explained everything. He explained that it was, I mean, the obvious thing was I wanted to know why has that happened to me? Is there any reason? And he said, well, your case is what we would call idiopathic, which means that we can't actually explain why it has happened, which again is something really difficult in terms of psychologically trying to kind of come to terms with something that has happened to you, to be told that the medical profession is not able to explain why this has happened to you. They just don't know. There hasn't been enough research done to kind of provide information on this, to kind of provide a greater understanding of why this happens to women. So, and from knowing other women now with POI, I understand that that's quite common for women to be told we don't actually know why this has happened.
So just to explain, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who don't know what POI is.
So from what I've learned, when we are conceived, you are conceived and born with a certain number of primordial egg follicles. And as you hit puberty and go through your life and you start menstruating, you start your periods, your egg follicles will mature and an egg follicle will be released, not necessarily every month. And if that isn't fertilized, then you have your period.
Mm.
So when that store of egg follicle runs out, then that's when women go into menopause, because there are no egg follicles left. So you're not menstruating anymore. Premature ovarian insufficiency, and the average age for women to hit menopause is in their early 50s, about 51, 52. So premature ovarian insufficiency is defined as when a woman has become menopausal before the age of 40. And it happens to about 1% of women before the age of 40. And it's an even smaller percentage of women that it happens to before the age of 30 and before the age of 20. Some women who have premature ovarian insufficiency to such an extent that it means that they don't actually start to menstruate. Now, I was having my periods up to when I was 39, when I was 37 and 38. I mean, I might have had like 3, 4, 5, 6 months between a period. So they were really, really scattered. So, yeah, premature ovarian insufficiency is when you are born with less than the average number of primordial egg follicles than other women.
You've spoken before about how there was a sense of shame for you and that you almost felt as though you aren't sure that you were fully a woman. You know, all these complicated feelings. Can you tell me a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah, again, it was there were a lot of very difficult emotions to digest around receiving that news that I couldn't have my own biological child. And I think because it was just so much built into my expectation of what my life going forward is going to be, that expectation that I was going to be a mother, that I was going to have a child, it was something that I had really, really, really wanted for years. Even though I wasn't a mother, I didn't have a child, it still had become a really important part of my identity. So suddenly to be faced with that news that that was not going to happen, it really, I suppose, was one of those moments where parts of my identity started to crumble. And I had to look and say, well, who am I if I'm not this?
Yeah.
If I'm not a mother, then what's left? And what makes me who I am? I think it's also what made it more difficult is because of the societal expectations around women, that it is the norm when you're a woman to have children, even for women who perfectly legitimately may choose not to have children, who don't want to have children. There is that feeling that that's not normal. And for women who can't have children, and it's not something that's talked about a lot, I think that contributes to the feeling of shame and the stigma and, well, there's something wrong with me because I can't do this thing that so many women can so easily do and that society tells us that we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And also the whole silence around the fact that premature ovarian insufficiency actually exists. I didn't even know the word perimenopausal, let alone premature ovarian insufficiency. And I was landed with all this information and new terminology and identity shattering news pretty much all within a short space of time, but to handle all on my own. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't in a relationship at the time. And that's the other thing, I suppose society assumes that you are going to kind of live your life in a relationship as well, in a relationship, in kind of what they define as a normal family unit with children. So suddenly there were all these boxes that I thought I would tick at some point that I suddenly realised were going to be left unticked. And I was finding myself more and more and more outside what was considered normal and what was even talked about.
Mm.
And it was a very lonely place to be, really, really lonely, because that was the other thing. I didn't really know where to turn for information or for support.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't in that consultation when the results were being explained to me. I wasn't told, like, that there is a support group in, it was in Scotland at the time, and there is a support group for premature ovarian insufficiency in the UK, I now know, called the DAISY Network. But I first heard about the DAISY Network when I finally found a GP specialised in menopause when I came back to Dublin 5 years later.
Yeah.
So I didn't hear about it then. I wasn't told that I should possibly seek counselling. It was another mentor that said, you need to put support in place. And so I got support from a psychotherapist. The medical profession, the GP, the consultant, the private consultant that I saw, and a year later, a specialist consultant on the NHS that I saw, I specifically remember asking questions, what is there that I need to be aware of, that I need to do in terms of exercise, nutrition, etc. And they said, no, that there's nothing in particular that you need to be aware of.
Mm. So tell me about that. When you moved back to Dublin, you'd been living abroad for 20 years. And it was a friend, a GP friend in Scotland, wasn't it, who suggested that you should try and find a GP in Ireland who specialises in menopause.
Yeah, I was so lucky to have her. She was the friend who came with me to the appointments once I realised in Scotland I need someone to come with me.
Mm.
And I was really lucky that she was a junior doctor, and she was an ophthalmologist at the time. Now she's a GP, but she was an ophthalmologist at the time. And she was really, really aware of her lack of knowledge in the area and really concerned that because of her lack of knowledge that we were missing something. So when I eventually came back to Ireland in 2017, she started to put pressure on me to go find somebody specialised in menopause. So I asked around a little bit. I mean, if I was going to, like, for my smear test, I would ask the nurse, or if I was going to the GP for something, I would kind of tell them that I had premature ovarian insufficiency. But there didn't seem to be, again, there wasn't kind of any urgency or kind of indication that, oh, you should be seeing somebody who specialised in menopause.
Mm.
But at the same time, I had seen kind of a couple of specialists. And so I thought, well, I've asked the questions and I'm being told that it's fine, that I don't need to be concerned about anything. But my friend really kept putting pressure on me. She said, no, like, she was really, really insistent. And I was like, but I've asked. I mean, how can I find out? So she said, just find somebody who is friends with the doctor. GPs are specialised in different areas, and ask them. So
yeah.
I messaged somebody who I knew was really good friends with the doctor, and the answer came back in 5 minutes, you need to see Dr. Deirdre Lundy. So I went on a waiting list for Dr. Deirdre Lundy in the Bray Women's Health Clinic. And again, this was pure luck. And it was also, I was really, really fortunate to be in a position where I knew somebody who knew a doctor that well, and that I was able to get that information. Mm. And I was also very lucky that I was able to afford to pay for the consultation in the Bray Women's Health Clinic, because the menopause consultations aren't cheap there.
Mm.
And there wasn't anything on the public service at that stage. So when I went to see Deirdre Lundy for the first time in, this was 2019, early 2019 at that stage, the first thing she said to me was, when I told her what had happened, she shook her head and she said, we've lost 5 years. We need to get you a DEXA scan. So she sent me for, and a DEXA scan is a scan that measures the bone density in your bones.
Mm.
And what I didn't know, what nobody had told me up to that point, was that apparently it's very well known that accelerated menopause or early menopause is associated with low bone density. So one of the first things that you should do, particularly if you're if you have early menopause, is go get your bone density checked.
Mm.
So when I eventually got the DEXA scan later that year and the results came back, it turned out that I had osteopenia. And osteopenia is when your bone density is lower than what the average bone density is. It's not quite osteoporosis, but my osteopenia was borderline osteoporosis. So it was quite low. And that made me feel really angry when I got those results. And the reason was that there are things that you can do to protect your bone density if you have that information on time. There are, you can pay more attention to your diet to make sure that you're eating certain types of food and avoiding certain types of food. There are supplements that you can take. There's particular types of exercise that are better for bone density rather than others. For example, the exercise that I would have naturally been doing would have always been, say, swimming and cycling. But that's not weight-bearing exercise. So that's not exercise that necessarily contributes to your bone density. So weight-bearing exercise would be more like running or hiking. So I knew none of this until 2019. And I had been diagnosed with premature ovarian insufficiency in 2014.
Yeah. And this is why it's so important for people who have POI to be diagnosed as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That there are people out there who have this and who aren't aware. And as such, they might be in a similar situation to you, that they're losing years of looking after their bone health when they could be.
Absolutely. And again, I was fortunate in that when I looked at my diet, I was, because I generally have a healthy diet, I was mostly eating the things that I should be eating and avoiding the things that I should be avoiding.
Mm.
But again, it's very different kind of having that information and being conscious of, consciously knowing that you are supporting your body because there is something that you need to support. Yeah. In terms of exercise, I mean, I started running after I found out that I had low bone density, but I could have done that 5 years earlier. And the thing is, the younger you start focusing on diet and exercise, the younger you start on supporting your bone density, the better it is, because your body produces less bone density, or your bone density is less able to change or be improved the older you get. So those that loss of 5 years was really, really important. It really made a difference. So I was at a huge disadvantage from not having had that information 5 years earlier.
One way to deal with bone density issues is to go on HRT, but you chose not to do that.
Yes. When I went to see Dr. Deirdre Lundy, and she specialises in HRT and hormones generally, so she was really encouraging me to go on HRT, and her reasoning was to bring me back up to the base level of hormone levels that somebody my age would have. I was reluctant to go on HRT for a couple of reasons. One was that I've been very lucky in that I've never had any menopausal symptoms that are visible or that have affected me or that I can feel. I mean, the accelerated bone density loss is a symptom, but that was one that I wasn't aware of. But in terms of the usual symptoms that you hear about, like the hot flushes or the brain fog or the sleeplessness or the migraines or the myriad of other symptoms that are listed as menopausal symptoms, I had none of those. And that's usually the main reason why people go on HRT. Is to alleviate those symptoms. And even though I knew that the logic behind taking HRT was to support my bone density, I was really hesitant to take HRT when I didn't have any symptoms that would be combated by the HRT. Also, what I did was I wanted to kind of find more out about whether there were other ways that I, like obviously diet and exercise, other ways that I could support my bones. What I really appreciate about Dr. Deirdre Lundy is that she really listens. Like, she didn't try to pressure me. She said, like, this is your decision to make. This is what I would recommend. This is your decision to make. So I went off and did a bit more research. And again, I found a fantastic resource in the UK. The Royal Osteoporosis Society has a free helpline with specialist nurses in osteoporosis.
Oh, yeah.
You can ring. And I must have had about four or five different conversations with them, learned a lot more about osteoporosis, osteopenia, my bones. And they were actually quite supportive of kind of where I wanted to go, which was trying diet and exercise for a couple of years first. And they were saying, well, yeah, given that you don't have symptoms and given how young you are, we think that this is a logical and sensible path to take as well. So when I went back to Deirdre Lundy and discussed it, she said, OK, let's do a 2 year plan. Do this for 2 years, because usually you have a DEXA scan or a bone density scan every 2 years to kind of monitor your bone density. And she said, do that for 2 years. And there were vitamin supplements that I had found, and she ticked the box on those and said, yes, take the vitamin supplements, do your exercise, monitor your diet, and then have a DEXA scan in 2 years. And let's discuss it again and see where we go from there. So that's pretty much where I'm at now. My next DEXA scan is in a couple of weeks' time. I'm not quite sure what choices I'm going to be faced with after that.
Yeah. And have you any idea why you haven't had any of the other symptoms? Is there an explanation or a reason for that?
That's another marvellous mystery around women's health.
Just really lucky in that way.
Just, there are so many unknowns. I have absolutely no idea. Nobody can explain it to me. I really, really don't know. I really don't know. And also, there seems to be some confusion as to whether when I get to the age, the so-called normal age for menopause, like 50, 51, 52, whether I might still start having symptoms or not. So I don't know whether that's the case. But at the moment, I mean, I'm 5 years. You're technically menopausal 1 year after your last period.
Yeah.
So I think I'm 5 years or 5.5 years postmenopausal now.
Yeah.
So I would hope that I don't have any symptoms.
Mm. What would you say are the main ways in which POI has affected your life?
Psychologically was the main way. And partly that's because I haven't had any physical symptoms of menopause. So for me, it was psychologically around identity, around trying to redefine myself as how I am a woman in this world who has been told she's infertile and is not going to have children. It's initially, I think, the first couple of years I really struggled with the shame around it and the grief. I went through a really, really deep grieving process for those children I would never have. Mm-hmm. That I was so sure that I would have. And it took me a few years to go through that process before I was able to start thinking about what is it that I do have, as opposed to what is it that I don't have if I don't have children. So to flip it and go, what kind of life will I be able to have without children that I maybe couldn't have had if I had had children?
Yeah.
And one of the most important things that helped me to flip, it was really like there was a tipping point to flip into that place of kind of visualizing the life that I could have, was just, again, really strangely and unpredictably, I ended up in a place that I never ever thought I would live and work, which was Israel-Palestine. And again, completely unexpectedly, a lot of my friends that I met when I was living and working there happened to be from the queer community and were my age as well, kind of in their 40s. So I was suddenly a part of people's lives whose lives did not fit the norm at all. And these were people who were immensely creative, who had incredibly rich lives, and who were kind of designing their own kind of family units and ways of living and were living very fulfilling and rich lives. And I think that was hugely important for me to be a part of that community for that year that I was there. First, kind of just to see the different ways that people can live their lives. Because if you're not a part of that community, it's not necessarily something that, I mean, it's certainly not necessarily something that is visible in the mainstream media.
No.
So I was hugely lucky to have that window of that year to kind of experiencing life within that community. And that was a massive turning point for me in terms of coming back to, I felt like kind of really sitting within myself and who I was, and almost like reclaiming myself as a woman. Reclaiming myself as a whole woman. I think there was a certain amount of kind of holing that was going on, and that I was recognizing that I am still fully me.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that really, really helped was, so I came back to Dublin in 2017. In 2008, and I had been looking around like for books on menopause, perimenopause, people's journeys, etc. And there was nothing that I saw that was really grabbing me. Again, there seems to be a kind of a dearth of kind of literature in this area. And I found, apart from kind of the stuff that you'll find, it was all around symptoms and menopausal symptoms. So it's all about kind of the physical, the physiological aspects. But there wasn't so much about kind of the mental, the emotional, the psychological, the spiritual even. And in 2018, I came across a school in the UK called the Red School. And I had heard of them before because they do work around menstruality awareness, cycling with awareness, becoming more aware of your kind of period cycles. And they had just developed a course for menopause, and it was an online course, which was perfect. And it was over, I think, maybe 6 weeks or 2 months. So I signed up to that course, and that again was a really transformative piece that actually helped me come to terms with what had happened. Because what they have done, they have actually created a language to articulate what happens during the kind of the coming up to menopause, menopause and postmenopausal experience. And it just happened that the language and the framework that they developed actually fit for me. It probably wouldn't fit for everybody. I think there's a need for many different ways of describing this process, particularly for premature ovarian insufficiency, but also for menopause more generally. And they've divided it into five different stages. So they talk about betrayal, repair, revelation, visioning and emergence. But for me, the really key bit was that the first stage was betrayal.
Yeah.
Because I had felt completely betrayed by my body. But I'm not sure if I had actually managed to articulate it to myself using that word, betrayal. And for somebody who had been, I mean, even though I hadn't done any Red School courses, kind of listening to what they're cycling with awareness when you have your periods had been, like being very aware of your body, etc. I had been doing that for years beforehand. So I'd been very, very aware of my body. But I had been, when I was diagnosed with premature ovarian insufficiency, there was almost this, my relationship with my body changed, particularly with my reproductive organs changed. And having that framework where the first stage was betrayal, it was really important for me to acknowledge that, that I had felt betrayed by my body, and to actually go through that stage, and to going through that stage meant that I could actually kind of circle around and come back and start rebuilding a relationship with my own body, with my reproductive organs, and with ultimately myself emotionally, psychologically, spiritually as a woman.
That was Ruth Brennan on Bits of Me. This was a bonus episode, and there are currently no more episodes in the pipeline, but if you want to listen to more conversations about women's health, there's a back catalogue of another 44 episodes of Bits of Me on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.